Thank you, Nikki. John Wesley, to whom we owe our Methodist heritage, once wrote an important sermon entitled A Catholic Spirit. Here the word Catholic is to be understood as universal or all-embracing, spelled with a lowercase c. He's not talking about Roman Catholicism. I remember how, as a boy, I was puzzled by the phrase in the Apostles' Creed that we used to cite each Sunday in church. I believe in the Holy Catholic Church. Then it was explained to me that Catholic in this sense means the universal Christian Church, not the Roman Catholic Church. So Wesley's sermon is about the relation of Christians to one another. He prefaces his sermon by insisting that we Christians are to love all of our fellow human beings, including non-Christians. The commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself, which is right here on the door in stained glass, refers to all other human beings, not merely other Christians. Yet Wesley does go on to note that in addition to loving all our fellow human beings, the New Testament calls us to a special love for our fellow Christians. And that's what his sermon is about. By a Catholic spirit, then, he means our love for our fellow Christians of whatever church and of whatever denomination. Today, I'm calling this an ecumenical spirit. Now, what prompted Wesley to write a sermon on this topic? He explains that, in fact, Christians don't always love one another. Then he cites many instances of controversies that have deeply divided Christians from one another. These controversies are of two kinds, having to do with differences in belief and action. Sometimes Christians have disagreed vehemently with one another over what we are to believe. Not all Christians teach the same doctrines or agree on theology or interpret the Bible in the same way. And these theological differences lead to differences in practice or action. Some Christians baptize infants and others do not. Some churches ordain women and others do not. The list could go on and on. Hence, Wesley's sermon addresses the question how we can love other Christians who don't agree with us theologically or ethically or whose practice of worship differs from ours. Growing up in the United Methodist Church, I was taught early on to have an ecumenical spirit toward other Christians. Like the word Catholic, the word ecumenical also means universal. It comes from the Greek word for world. I remember how we learned about the ecumenical movement in Sunday school. I knew that other Protestants, such as Presbyterians and Baptists, Lutherans, Congregationalists, and Episcopalians, were more or less like us Methodists, and for that reason, we didn't have any particular reason to polemicize against them as being false Christians. Catholics, however, were in a different category. We tended to look upon the Catholics with suspicion. I recall hearing that they believed in the Pope, not the Bible. Moreover, the fact that they prayed to Mary and other saints was seen by us as unbiblical. Still, Catholics weren't the ones who came in for our most scathing criticisms. These were reserved for what we called sects, Mormons, Christian Scientists, and Jehovah's Witnesses. I was taught that these groups weren't truly Christian, even though they claimed to be Christian. So our ecumenical spirit did not extend to them. We viewed them as dangerous and believed that their doctrines were false and therefore could mislead us away from the true faith. As I grew older, I learned what a difference American history had made to our reasons for being ecumenical. Prior to the birth of our country, freedom of religion was rarely to be found in Europe. Throughout the Middle Ages, it was expected that all members of European society would be Christians. And in Western Europe, the Roman Catholic Church was the only official form of Christianity. All other Christian movements were suppressed or persecuted. When the Protestant reformers broke with the Roman Catholic Church in the 16th century, many Protestants were executed for their faith. But not even the Protestants were champions of religious liberty. Protestants persecuted and killed those who dissented from their teachings. A famous Unitarian Christian was burned at the stake in Calvin's Geneva for denying the doctrine of the Trinity. And many Baptist Christians were executed by other Protestants for denying infant baptism. And they were usually killed by drowning so as to mock their belief that Christians must be baptized by immersion. Then the wars of religion tore Europe apart for about a century. It apparently didn't occur to these Christians, whether they were Catholics or Protestants, that Christians of various persuasions could live together in harmony without persecuting and killing one another. It was only with the birth of the United States that the principle of religious liberty was legally and politically established for the first time in history. What an achievement that was. Wesley lived during the 18th century when our nation was first conceived. Hence, his concern that love for one's fellow Christians had not always been a reality was more urgent in that context. Ecumenism, in our modern sense, was a new idea. Perhaps Christians could disagree with one another on issues of doctrine and practice, and yet live harmoniously together as fellow citizens of a single nation. What an idea. My own experience growing up in this country bore out the fruitfulness of this idea. We had Protestant families of various denominations, as well as a Catholic family and a Jewish family on our street. All of us kids played together, and our parents were very good friends with one another. Still, we knew that there were religious differences between us, and while these were not to be taken lightly, they weren't reason to hate one another. In fact, we loved one another, Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. For us at that time, that was as far as religious diversity extended. We knew nothing about Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus, and there were no atheists that we knew of. Today, our experience of religious diversity has been greatly expanded by the flux of immigrants from non-Western countries, and we now know about Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam as well. While our age may not be as parochial as Wesley's age was, the issues that concerned him aren't very much the same today. While he wanted us to extend love to all people, including non-Christians, as well as Christians with whom we disagree about various matters, he didn't want us to be indifferent to questions of truth in religion. If Christians in previous centuries overemphasized the importance of finding agreement on religious and theological questions, we today may perhaps underestimate the importance of having clearly articulated religious and theological convictions by which to live our lives. Think about this. If we are rightly worried about the negative effects of intolerance, we may fear that caring about truth in religion and theology could be an obstacle to fostering tolerance. I had a number of students over the years at the seminary where I used to teach who did not want to take theological controversies seriously out of fear that giving importance to theological questions would prevent us from living in harmony with others. But Wesley was opposed to this. As he said, a Catholic spirit is not indifference to all opinions. Not all claims to truth can be equally valid. So if we care about the truth in general, we cannot be indifferent to questions of truth in religion and theology. Not all religions can be equally right about what they teach. Not all Christians can be equally right about what they teach when they disagree with other Christians. So how then can we foster love for all of our fellow human beings and for all of our fellow Christians without being indifferent to the issues of belief and practice that divide us? That's the heart of the problem that Wesley's identifying. He wanted us to pursue both goals simultaneously, to believe that truth in religion and theology really matters and thus has to be taken with utter seriousness, and also to affirm that love is never to be violated as we recognize that ours is a world of deep religious and theological pluralism. The problem that Wesley identified has been with us ever since the first generation of Christians. Notice how in the two readings from the Apostle Paul that Nikki read for us, Paul is simultaneously trying to grab both horns of the dilemma. On the one hand, Paul wants Christians to be tolerant of one another when it comes to their differing practices, such as whether to eat certain foods or to abstain from eating them, or whether to observe certain days as being of special religious importance. He therefore exhorts his Christians to welcome one another, but not for disputes over opinions. On the other hand, there are some differences between Christians that are of such great importance that Paul feels impelled to denounce them vehemently. He writes, "If anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to that which you received from me, let him be accursed." How are we supposed to hold these two attitudes together? On the one hand, he tells us to be tolerant of one another and not to judge. On the other hand, he condemns those who disagree with him on matters that seem to him to strike at the very heart of what it means to be a Christian. Wesley took very much the same double position as did Paul. Wesley used to cite as his motto, "In essentials, unity. In non-essentials, liberty. In all things, love." But who's to decide what the essentials are? Paul and his Christian opponents disagreed on what was essential to a proper understanding of Christian faith and the practical implications that followed from it. When Protestants broke with Catholics, they disagreed on what was essential to a proper understanding of the gospel, and they could not be reconciled with one another. 500 years later, Protestants and Catholics remain divided. And that's why we have a Catholic church right across the street from our own Protestant church. Right now, Christians are engaged in disputes with one another that are equally divisive. Within our own Methodist denomination, there is talk of a split over conflicting understandings of biblical authority and human sexuality. I have to confess that I don't think there's any easy way to hold Wesley's two concerns together, truth and love, though I completely believe that both concerns are necessary and equally necessary. We need to adopt an ecumenical or a Catholic spirit toward those who are different from us religiously and theologically, whether they are Christians or non-Christians. I think we live in an age that is unique in human history. Ours is now truly a global world in which religious and theological diversity have taken on a new form right here in our own backyard in the United States. Today there is a mosque in my hometown, and I have personally known Buddhists and Hindus. These non-Western religions are no longer encountered only in books. Their adherents have become our neighbors, and their children go to school with our children. Here, too, the commandment applies, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." When we talk about these religions and their adherents, we need to tell the truth about them. Stereotypes and half-truths will no longer suffice. We have no excuse anymore when it comes to knowing what these religions are all about and how they differ from our own. And as Wesley recognized, such religious diversity is not going away anytime soon. Wesley attributed this diversity in part to the fact that human understanding is limited and partial. He wrote, "Many good men entertain peculiar opinions." So long as we know but in part, all men will not see all things alike. It is an unavoidable consequence of the present weakness and shortness of human understanding that several men will be of several minds in religion as well as in common life. So it has been from the beginning of the world, and so it will be. Notice how Wesley acknowledges that good people can disagree in religion. This is what's new about the ecumenical or Catholic spirit he's talking about. We should not deny the genuine humanity of those who are different from us religiously and assume that they must all be agents of Satan. For this reason, Wesley says, every wise man will allow others the same liberty of thinking which he desires that they should allow him. I dare therefore not impose my mode of worship on any other. Everyone must follow the dictates of his own conscience. He must be fully persuaded in his own mind and then act according to the best light he has. This is Wesley's Christian justification for freedom of religion. An ecumenical or a Catholic spirit is thus a humble spirit. But there is the other side of the matter too, and that's the question of truth. Who's right? In our concern for love, we cannot be indifferent to truth. Because of the new opportunities for personal encounter with people of non-Christian religions today, there have been serious and productive dialogues between Christians and non-Christians about our religious differences. I was engaged in one such dialogue with Jews for 2 years when I was a student in seminary. As a result, I learned a great deal not only about Jews and Judaism, but also about how Jews perceive Christians and Christianity that forever altered my perceptions of my own religion. I've had less experience with dialogue between Christians and members of non-Western religions, though I would be glad to participate in it. But the biggest puzzle for me is that it is not so much with non-Christians that I have my greatest and most intense disagreements, but rather with my fellow Christians. My most intense controversies are with those in my own religious tradition and not with those in other religious traditions. I personally don't get all riled up by the differences between Christianity and Hinduism or those between Christianity and Islam. Moreover, I don't even feel the need to argue with Catholics about why I believe what I believe as a Protestant. My most intense disagreements are with my fellow Protestants when I think they are wrong about some matter of belief and practice. Why is this? I think it may be true of all religions that their most polemical energies are reserved for those within their own fold. I observed this when I was engaged in Jewish-Christian dialogue. The arguments that our Jewish participants had with one another about what it means to be a Jew were far more heated than any of the disagreements they had with us Christians. That, by the way, is why we find so much criticism of Jews and Judaism in the New Testament, because all the early Christians were Jews. That's why we find such intense criticism of Catholicism and Catholics in the Protestant reformers of the 16th century, because all of them were Catholics. That's why Methodists today are at each other's throats about sexuality, because we're all members of the same church family. A secular analogy is the intensity with which Democrats and Republicans fight with one another in this country. We are all Americans, and thus our deepest emotional investment lies in defining what it means to be an American today against those other Americans who disagree with us about America. As I listen to the evening news, I have the impression that it's easier for an American to love a foreigner than for a Democrat to love a Republican or vice versa. As a Methodist, I think it's easier to love a non-Methodist than another Methodist on the other side of the heated issues dividing us. Today is World Communion Sunday. It was first celebrated in 1933 as an ecumenical gesture designed to foster harmony as well as mutual respect and greater understanding among the various churches that are divided by doctrine and theology, ethics and worship. Even today, it serves as an important reminder that all of us who are Christians, whatever our denomination, are members of a larger universal Christian church. In spite of all our differences from one another, this ritual that we're about to celebrate is a symbolic acknowledgement that we are nevertheless united in a common faith with other Christians who believe that Jesus is God's definitive self-revelation to us. As we partake of the bread and the wine, as we recall Jesus' words at the Last Supper, "This is my body which is given for you. This is my blood of the new covenant poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." We should take this celebration as an occasion to remind ourselves that we know only in part, that our understanding of our own Christian faith is never perfect and complete, but is always open to new insights from other Christians. And though we should always be ready to stand up for the truth as we see it, we must do so in a spirit of humility, in a Catholic spirit, as Wesley said, or in an ecumenical spirit, as I am calling it. We bear witness to the truth of the gospel as it has been given to us to know and to understand. But we do not claim to be infallible. We remain open to learning new insights and to better formulations of the truth. When I was in high school, my best friend was a Mormon. Back then, I was very impressed with how certain Danny Donaldson was that his church and his church alone taught the true gospel. Once he even said to me, "You know, my church is the true church." I didn't know what to say in response. I was completely caught off guard. His absolute certainty made me feel very uncertain. I had never been taught that the United Methodist Church was the only true church. But if I had been as well educated theologically back then as I am today, I would have replied to Danny, "We do not claim that ours is the only true church. But we do claim that ours is a true church. Not the one true church, but a true church." That's a very significant distinction. We are willing to acknowledge that there are other true churches, especially other Protestant churches, but maybe even other churches as well. Yet our refusal to absolutize ourselves or to claim that ours alone is the true church is not a sign of weakness, but of strength. For us, it's not a matter of all or nothing. It's a matter of degree. We believe that we preach and teach the gospel of Jesus Christ with fidelity, and we are willing to grant that some other churches do the same as well. And if at the present time we happen to be wrong about some other churches, we are open to being better instructed and even corrected in our perceptions of them. Unfortunately, the ritual of communion that we are about to celebrate has not always been a source of unity among Christians. Instead, it became a bone of contention and a source of division, and you can read about it in the bulletin insert. During the Reformation era, not only did Catholics and Protestants disagree with one another as to how communion should be understood, but even the Protestants couldn't agree with one another about communion. And these doctrinal differences are the major reason we Protestants never formed a unified church, all because we couldn't agree on how communion is to be understood. While all Protestants rejected what the Catholics were teaching, they couldn't agree among themselves as to what Jesus meant when he said, "Holding the bread, this is my body, and holding the cup, this is my blood." For this reason, we ended up with our first splits among Protestants who couldn't agree as to how to interpret the Bible. I would like to think that today we can do better than this. So, my friends, as we gather for this meal, Let us be humble as we bear our Christian witness to non-Christians. And let us be humble as we continue to argue with our fellow Christians as to how the gospel is best understood and practiced. Amen.